Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, depending upon where you are. Sorry for the fashionably late start today, but hey, we're like that sometimes. Thanks for joining us for another virtual event. And today we're delighted to have Polly Stewart with us, talking about her book here, The Good Ones. And we are expecting some autographed copies. I'll go ahead and put a link in the comment field should you wish to purchase one. And also Megan Miranda joins us.
Hey.
Hey, here's her latest novel, The Only Survivors. We also have signed copies, and I'll put a link to this book as well. And if you have questions throughout the hour for Polly or Megan, go ahead and put them in. And Barbara usually will bring me back on screen towards the end of the hour. I'll be happy to ask any of your questions. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. Very well done. So welcome, Polly. It's so nice to have you here. And Megan, a treat to see you. I'm trying to think, was it April when you were here? Yeah, it was. So Megan is just like one of the best interviewers I know. We got into a groove on during COVID. So I'm always delighted when she can join us. But most of you probably haven't met Polly yet. So let me just give you a few words about her. She grew up in Radford, Virginia, where, as I pointed out to her earlier, there's an actual psychiatric unit. Don't ask me how I know that, but it wasn't me. All right, she graduated from Hollins, has an MFA in fiction and a PhD in British literature from Washington University in St. Louis, where our friend Q Shalong is a writing teacher. Do you know?
Professor? No, I graduated in 2013 with my PhD, so they may have come after I.
No, he's been there for a long time. He's Chinese, and he's a poet, and you probably know him as Chu Shalong's.
Oh, that does sound familiar. I don't write poetry, unfortunately, but.
No, but he teaches writing at Washington University. Anyway, one of my favorite authors, and really brilliant about, he gets information out of communist China, so he's able to update Inspector Chen, the poet detective inspector from Shanghai, to tell us about communist China. Anyway, just an aside there for what I saw at Washington University. She's the author of the novel Wild Girls. Her fiction has appeared in many collections, and she teaches creative writing at Virginia VMI and lives in Lexington, Virginia. Now, that threw me for a minute. Virginia Military Institute and creative writing.
It's not two things a lot of people would put together.
No. But
it's why it's important, I think. They need a creative outlet.
But isn't there enrollment primarily people going into the military?
It's actually 50-50 now, 50% of the cadets commission. But I think even for the ones who do, you know, learning how to use their creativity and express themselves is a great thing. I try to help with that.
I think it's wonderful. I was just kind of faintly surprised. I think Brad Taylor, who's a notable thriller writer, has taught at VMI, if I'm not mistaken.
I know the name.
Yeah, he's great. So Megan Miranda, what can I tell you about Megan? Best-selling author. Patrick just showed you her most recent book. How many books have you written now, Megan?
14. My first six were young adults. So I think this was my seventh or eighth adult book. Yes.
Right. And we had a great conversation in April about all that. And you can find it on the same Facebook or YouTube pages for The Poison Pen. As you will be watching this, you can just scroll down and you will find Megan. You'll be happy to know that Rob is about to employ, my husband is going to use ChatGPT to alphabetize all of these videos, because there's like 1,050 of them by now. And you can't easily find it. So we want to alphabetize it by author. So if I say Megan Miranda, you can go, and there it all is. Or now Polly Stewart, right? So Megan, who's very familiar with Appalachia and the country that this book is set in, has kindly agreed to do the interview. So I'm going to turn it over to Megan.
Oh, thank you. I'm always so excited to join you. And I think you totally know my taste in books, because this was completely up my alley. I loved your book so much, Polly. You know, it's just so beautifully written and atmospheric and haunting, with really intriguing, interesting characters and just everything I love in a thriller. And I feel like even more than that, the books that linger go into something even deeper and they ask deeper questions. And I feel like yours does that in really interesting ways that just have made me think about this book since I finished reading it. So thank you, first of all, for the great read. And I thought, you know, before I get into my questions, for the people who might not be familiar with what the book's about, could you give kind of a brief overview and what your way in to the story was? I'm always intrigued by that. Like, was it a plot point? Was it a character? Was it the setting? So whatever you'd like to talk about that way.
Sure. And thank you so much, Megan. I mean, I've just been a fan of yours for years. So I'm so thrilled that you enjoyed the book, and I'm happy to be here at the famous Poison Pen. So thank you guys for having me. So the book is set in the Blue Ridge Mountains where I grew up. It's the main character is a woman named Nicola Bennett, who grew up in a small town in Virginia, has moved back after the death of her mother. And it's kind of a fraught homecoming for her because one of her good friends disappeared 15 years earlier when she was in her early 20s. She was a young wife and mother. So Nicola comes back not really intending to get involved with the investigation, which is still open, but she ends up becoming close again to a lot of the people she knew in high school and just getting really tangled up in the questions of what happened to her friend Lauren. And the starting point for me was actually a real missing persons case. I lived in Springfield, Missouri for a while about 10 years ago, and I'm sure you guys are probably familiar with the case of the Springfield Three, which is three, a mother, a daughter, and the daughter's best friend, who the girls had just graduated from high school, went to a party, came home, and then the next morning, all three of them were gone, left all their things, and the case is still unsolved. They've never been found. So to me, obviously, that's a great, I mean, it's a narrative puzzle, but I think it's also just made me think a lot about the people who would be left behind. In the real story, one of their friends came over the next day and was the first person to discover that they were missing. And I just thought, what would that be like then to go on leading your life, knowing that you'd been so close to this horrific event? So that's what I wanted to explore.
Oh, that's fascinating. And I can totally see that now that you mention that as kind of the launching point. And I think since you mentioned that idea of the friend coming over and realizing, you know, they were the one left behind. And I feel like that this really is kind of a heart and the theme that's running through this book is the people left behind and how they've been impacted by it. But there was, you had such beautiful lines in your book that I would go back and reread them and like flag them. And one of them near the start, I felt like was really insightful and kind of got to this theme as well. You said around the circumstances of the disappeared, the dead or the missing girl is never the subject of the story. Sometimes she's not even object. And I just, that just resonated with me so much as, you know, there's, I think there's this also this thread of true crime running through the story and whether you're the subject of the true crime story or you're somebody who's following these true crime stories. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that because it is really Nicola's story, but it is the disappearance about Lauren.
Yeah, it's funny to realize, you know, this book was primarily written during the pandemic, and I think a lot of us were probably consuming a good bit of true crime during that time.
Guilty, yes.
So I'm definitely not the only person who's been thinking about these issues, but, you know, there is that way in which women in true crime are, they're almost treated as circumstances or accidents, you know, in which certain factors come together. So you talk about the people around them and you talk about what they were wearing and what they were doing that day and what happened right afterwards. And unless it's really careful programming, I think, and really responsible programming, they don't necessarily get treated as a human being who assumed that they had a rich future and had complicated relationships in their lives. So, you know, I think for those of us who maybe have true crime habits, but don't want to consume at risk. You know, these are issues that you have to think of how women are portrayed.
And I feel like Nicola too is almost trying to bring Lauren to life in the story and make her like she had her perspective of who she was when they were children, but kind of is trying to really go back years later and see her more as, like you were saying, like a fully fleshed person who had her whole life in front of her and see her in a very different dimension. And I really love their complicated relationship. I'm so intrigued by the complexities of female friendships and just the relationships in a lot of thrillers in general. And another line that I was like, this is beautiful, I have to come back to it, was she talks about her kind of complicated relationship both before and after she disappeared, and being very honest with the reader at one point and saying at one point, you know, it was as if the mountain on the horizon had vanished and suddenly I could see the view. And Lauren was, you know, such this big personality who consumed her life. And I just wanted to hear a little bit more about their dynamic when they were younger, as I think it's so important to the plot and everything that happens going forward as well.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for saying that. I mean, Lauren is she's an endlessly interesting character for me. I mean, I feel like I could write 10 more books about her. She's so complicated and interesting. But, you know, I think there's a way in which her husband, who's also introduced early on, Warren, and Lauren both play these very typical roles in high school where she's the pretty, I hate the term mean girl, but she's not always super nice to other people, and she has a lot of power in her environment and her community. And then Warren's a jock, he's very popular, he's very smart, and they both settle into these roles that they're very comfortable with, which I think any of us from small towns, you know, you knew those people. But obviously no one is that simple. No one's that lacking in dimension. So Nicola really saw them in those roles when she knew them when they were younger, and then she has the opportunity when she comes back to see them as people. And in some ways she resists that, I think, but hopefully by the end of the book, the reader sees them in their full complication.
Yeah, definitely. I felt like they both came alive throughout the story and in different ways. And I love how you showed us throughout the story. Like it is, it's a small town. I love writing about small towns. I love reading about small towns. I love living in a small town. And I feel like there's, you know, the way that you're known when you're younger in a small town can be hard to escape your perception, like how you're perceived. And Nicola comes back years later, and I think she's kind of faced with the way people perceive her, but also is seeing all these people from her past and perceiving them in a different way years later. So how did you go about kind of inhabiting the different time periods of each of these characters' headspaces and bringing them to life in that way?
Well, that's a great question. I love writing about high school, even though I hated high school itself. the voice of a teenage girl just still comes back very naturally to me. I still think I think in that voice a lot of the time. So writing, you know, their dialogue when they were younger and the way they related to each other was very, very natural for me. But obviously with novels, people always want to know, you know, which parts of it are autobiographical. And I did, like Nicola, move from the West Coast back to a small town in Virginia right before I started the book. And even though I wasn't living in my hometown, I had that experience of like, oh, I'm back in this area I grew up with, and now I'm older, and this is weird. So I think that part also came very naturally of just having to readjust to, you know, maybe a lot of the people around you expect you to be the same person that you used to be, and then you have to explain all the ways in which you're not. So it's an interesting dynamic. I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. And I thought your setting, speaking of settings, like setting as a character is something I just love. And it did, like the atmosphere just seeped out of this story. And you could tell like every character has a different relationship with the setting. And I think they have a very complicated relationship with the setting. And it's like that dynamic of what makes a place home. And I think there's things that the characters love about it, but also don't love about it. And I think I read an interview or a piece you wrote in Crime Reads about writing about small town Southern fiction and the complexities that go along with that. And I'd love you to talk a little bit more about that because I feel like it comes out so strongly in your book.
Thank you. Yeah, I love the small town South. I think you said you live in a small town as well. Unlike Nicola, I was very happy to move back to Virginia. My family's there. But I realize, you know, I'm very comfortable in my town. I'm not sure that my kids will always be. And I mentioned in that piece, you know, I have a stepchild who's non-gender conforming. I have a son who has special needs. And things are harder, you know, when you don't necessarily fit in a town where everyone knows each other. And we have a very welcoming community, but it just, I guess I think if they don't want to stay in a place like that, I would completely understand that. The small town ethos, it doesn't work for everybody. And not everybody enjoys, you know, when you go to Kroger, you're going to see 10 people, you know, within 10 minutes. I mean, for me at my age, that's wonderful for me. But in high school, I really resisted that. So it's a complicated place. And I don't think it's for everybody.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? And it really is for Megan too, or maybe even more for Megan. I mean, I've lived in a small town. I've lived in a small southern town, and you know, I grew up in cities, and now I live in a suburb. So I've done all that. Are small towns, the dynamics of small towns, always the same basic dynamic, regardless of where they are? Or do you think that like Appalachia, Blue Ridge, you know, versus southern versus southwest, are there differences?
That is a great question. And I will be honest that I actually didn't live in a small town until I moved down to the South. I grew up in New Jersey. I lived in cities. I lived in Boston. And I didn't live in a smaller town until my adulthood. And it is a college town. So there is a little bit more, I think, like it fluctuates a little more with, you know, during the time of year as well. And we're pretty close to a city. We're right outside of Charlotte. But I do think that maybe like that's why I love writing about small towns is the idea of a closed dynamic of where people think they know everything about one another, whether that is true or not, and that inherently there's just mysteries that you're not aware of inside of every person that you think you know. But I always feel like we're being like, I love small towns and I live in them. And then I'm writing thrillers set in small towns and kind of like, that's why I make up my small towns. Cause I feel like I'm taking someone's lovely place and then showing all the creepy things that live underneath. But I think maybe it's just the dynamic of the contained small town of people knowing everything about one another and not necessarily where it's set. But I've only lived in one.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm comparing the values of a small town of Virginia with a small town in Arizona. I agree the dynamics are largely the same. I think it's the values and the lifestyles that can really be different. You know, even the time zone thing that you were talking about, you know, I mean, in Arizona, you want to get up at like 4 a.m., which I would never have even thought of in my rational life because it's still cool. And, you know, so even the time, the rhythm of time is different here than it was back in Virginia where, you know, you'd sleep until 8 and it would be foggy and whatever it all is and just, you know, different. So is it the closed circle dynamic and that makes it so interesting?
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. I lived in, it was kind of more of a small city, I guess, but in California before I moved back here. And that was wonderful because, you know, I'd go to parties and I could assume that everyone voted the same way I did and basically had the same opinions I did, you know, and I definitely don't take that for granted in Virginia. The values are different. But I think what Megan was saying, and I could totally see this in your work now that you say that, is the closed community where everyone is involved in some way, whether they want to be or not. You know, you have to deal with people whether you like them or not. And I think for fiction, that just leads to such amazing possibilities.
Yes. Right. Like you've got a great path.
I think the thing that really illustrated that for me is that I belonged to a book club in my small town in Southwest Virginia for years with the same women. And I thought we were all on the same page and kind of had the same values. But they were all from there and I wasn't. And then in a neighboring town, this is a long time ago, an ordinance was passed where they were not going to teach evolution in the schools. They were reverting to a Baptist dynamic, and it was like Scopes. It was the Scopes trial revisited, and that's the moment when I realized that even though I thought, you know, we were kind of all the same and we had the same rhythms in that town, that there's giant gulf had just opened up. I mean, I could hardly believe it. You know, I still remember I sat there, but we've been reading great books. You know, we've been reading the Chicago Great Books programs and all. And yet suddenly this core difference, you know, showed up. It was really a shock.
Was that the end of the book club?
No, but it did encourage me to move away after a while, because I recognized that no matter how long I lived there, I would forever be an outsider. I just, you know, because those were not the values that I grew up with. And, you know, I just wondered, you know, I mean, whether you found this, had that same thoughts for some of your characters, that they thought they fit in, and then maybe all of a sudden some giant gulf opened in a moment like that, and you realize that, you know, maybe you were, the character was not really as integrated into the community. It'd have to be somebody probably who came there, not somebody who grew up there.
Yeah, that absolutely happens in the book, and it happens to me, yeah. I think, maybe to you, Megan, fairly often, where I'll think, oh, I thought we, you know, we're on the same page, like you said, Barbara, and clearly we're not. And I think, like I said, not everyone is going to be comfortable living in a place like that, and I think that is completely fine. You know, sometimes I question it myself. For me, it's just where it feels like home to me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can, and I see it in the struggle of Nicola when she comes back. Like there's all these roots that tie her to a place. And yet she's struggling with feeling like an outsider, I feel like, even though she grew up there. And it's a dynamic I find fascinating as well. Like insider, I think that is something that's easy to explore or very interesting to explore in those small town settings, like insider versus outsider, and what makes somebody a part of the community. And as Barbara was saying, I think every character in your book has something that was assumed about them that is just not the case. And they're just a very different, there's a moment, like an aha moment of every character as well. Kind of leads me to a question about plot as well, because I will admit I was surprised, like you got me with your plot. Like I love that, because I feel like as a thriller writer and like huge reader, you're always looking like, what's the twist going to be? What's the reveal going to be? And it was a jaw dropping moment, which I love that. And do you know the secrets of the characters, or do you know that when you're starting the book, or is it something that you discover as like, as you're discovering who the characters are?
Yeah, I'm so embarrassed to admit this, because I'm very much not a pantser, but I had no idea where this book was going, and I had a totally different ending in mind, and then I got surprised as well, which I think is maybe why it works for the reader. I was shocked.
I love that. Oh, that's fast. So you're usually someone who plots books, though.
Oh, very much. Yeah. The one I'm working on now, I've got note cards everywhere, and I like to lay everything out. But this one I wrote more, I didn't really know that I was going to send it out on submission. I didn't know what was going to happen with it. And I was just kind of trying to have fun. And so that's why I think a lot of it ended up coming together in the process. And it was really enjoyable in that way.
I love that. That's fascinating to me, that like, because I feel like I'm so used to like, this is my process and this is how I usually do things. And you have the freedom to kind of do something different with each different book. That's very interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be able to recreate that.
I feel like there's always magic at some point when you're writing a draft where some like threads start coming together and you like it creates something different. So no, I love hearing that, because I remember the feeling where I was like, oh, okay. No, that was fantastic. But I would also love to hear about, and this is like my nosy writer question, and I feel like everyone has a different story and I find it so interesting, but your path to kind of, and I know you also said you teach, but what was your path to writing thrillers?
Well, I grew up reading a lot of mysteries, and I've told this story a couple of times, so I'm sorry I'm repeating myself, but I was named after Dorothy Sayers' novel, her Lord Peter Wimsey books. His sister is Lady Mary, but she's called Polly. So I think it was meant to be that I would become a thriller writer. But I started out writing literary fiction. That was what I thought I wanted to do. And then it was just kind of, I didn't really know where my career was going. You know, like I said, I wasn't necessarily writing to publish at this point. And I just wanted to write a book that was really fun. And so I think I went back to those original influences and the books that I really loved and got me excited about writing. And to me, you know, I found my niche now. I love meeting thriller writers is amazing. You're all the nicest people in the world. And I love the genre, but I did feel I kind of stumbled into it, I guess you would say.
I love it. I feel like there's mystery in every genre, right? It's like there's always a question. And so I feel like in thrillers, we just pull that more to the surface maybe, but I do feel like there's a mystery writer in every writer.
Well, that's right. And I think so much about suspense now, but I think, you know, doesn't every writer want every scene to be suspenseful? I mean, that's how we keep pages turning. So you're absolutely right. I think thriller writers just bring that up to the surface a little more.
Yes. No, I love that. The other thing I wanted to talk about is your title, because I feel like it fits the book so well in so many different ways, whether it's the expectations of the characters or like, there's a question of who are the good ones in this story? And is there a definition of what a good one is? So did you, and maybe I'm asking this because I'm terrible at titles and never come up with them before. Like, did you know this title right away? Or was this something you wrote the book and then came up with it? Or how did that work for you?
Yeah, I had a couple different titles along the way. So this was maybe like halfway through the drafting process. And I'm sure the first reference for most people would be, you know, that thing like when you're in your 30s, like, oh, there aren't any good ones left, yeah. Right? For women, yeah. You can't find any good ones. And the two main male characters in this novel really think of themselves as the good ones. And I hope it kind of reveals like what a low bar that is. A lot of ways for guys to get called the good ones, you know, we're not asking a lot of them. But like you said, then it comes to reveal things about the other characters as well and resonate with them.
I love that. No, it was so impactful. I really, really enjoyed it. And, you know, I felt like the characters in particular, like I feel like there could have been a book about every one of these characters and their perspective through the story. Can you tell us a little bit about those main male characters, because I think they're fascinating as well, seeing them in the past and the present.
Yeah. So he has some negative sides, so I feel bad saying this, but Warren was partly inspired by my husband. Some of the good parts of Warren.
Okay.
He, you know, we didn't know each other in high school, but when we got together, he was an athlete. He was very handsome, and I was a big nerd in high school. So the way Nicola kind of thinks about Warren is sort of, wow, I can't believe that. I had a little bit of that feeling. And then I thought, how embarrassing is this? But as an adult, I'm still kind of drawn back into those high school roles. So he's very comfortable in that position, and he will never leave his hometown, and he will never leave the circle of people who knew him, because he still has this sort of status that he had as a high school athlete. And then his brother Sean is the other major male character, who's a little younger and has all the kind of issues of a younger brother. You know, he's slightly less of a good athlete, slightly less handsome. So he's the one who Nicola is originally drawn to, seems to be the nicer and sort of better intentioned of the two brothers. But I hope they both kind of step outside of those roles in various ways as we move forward.
Has either one of you had the opportunity to go to a high school reunion yet of any significance?
I haven't.
Well, I'm here to tell you, because I have been to my 25th and my 50th, and it's really interesting to track. You know, it's hard when you go back to high school, you just pointed that out, you kind of fall into the same roles that you were in high school, and then you have to sit there and look at the people that were amazing in high school often aren't. And the people that, you know, were just kind of ordinary suddenly are completely different. But even if you see that, it's hard to break that original caste system, because it is a caste system in high school, isn't it? It really is. You get assigned a role and a value fairly easily in high school, and it's almost impossible to break it until you leave. And then when you go back, there you are. So, you know, I you'll see what happens should you go to one of your high school reunions.
Yeah. Did teaching, because I know Nicola plays, she also has a role as substitute teacher at throughout the story. So was your background in teaching something that you pulled on when you were kind of seeing characters from a different light, not when you were in high school, but kind of more from a remove looking back at that caste system?
Yeah, I've never taught high school. I've avoided that. I've taught middle school and college. Other than my own children, I don't love being around teenagers. It's such an awkward time, as we've been talking about. But even with college, I see them come in as freshmen and then leave as seniors. And that's like 10 years of adulthood, those 4 years. And people do change so much. And yet, in a small community, just like we've been saying, you can get typecast very early. And that's always the person that you're going to be within that community. So I do see that on a daily basis. And it does kind of make me, not want to go back.
The other question, and I think we touched on this a little bit, but Barbara had kind of mentioned this a little bit, was I was fascinated by, it's almost like the dangers of the past. And I think you do this in a really interesting and also ominous way. There's the physical aspect of going back to a place where you've been, but there's also the dangers of becoming the person you used to be or being perceived by this. And I think there's also then the mystery, like Nicola's drawn back into this mystery, and it does become danger on the page as well, because if you're digging into something that people have kind of let go, does that put you in danger as well? So were you thinking about all of these different elements as you were writing? I felt like there were like definitely themes that you were pulling on, and I could feel like the danger coming in so many different ways, like to her as a person, like who she was almost becoming as she went back home as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, I think you may have had this experience too, but when you talk to a wonderful reader, you learn things about your own book that maybe you didn't know before. So you put that much, much better than I could have. But I will say my favorite thrillers are always the ones where character and plot are interacting in a way where it's not just things happening to a character, but it's them making things happen because of the person that they are. So I think Nicola coming back to her town, she has to deal with all these issues from the past. And then because she's so uncomfortable with the person that she is, in a lot of ways, she ends up getting into some really dangerous secrets, right? I mean, she ends up making some really dumb decisions that make her life exponentially worse. So I hope it was those things that I already knew about her character that kind of led me into those plot points rather than, imposing them.
Yeah. And I feel like that's the thing about thrillers that makes them so revealing of character, because like you and I could say, oh, that was a dumb decision. But like, I mean, I have no idea what I would do in that sort of situation. And like in a thriller, you have no luxury of time. You're just kind of put under the gun. And I think it's very revealing seeing what those characters do. And I loved how active she was in trying to find answers both in the past and the present and what she was willing to do to get it. I think it was really impactful, and it's definitely a story that has lingered with me. And I know you said, so is thrillers now where you find yourself writing in the future? And if so, can you give us a sneak peek of what you might be working on next? Is it also going to be small town?
It is. And yes, I'm actually even more excited about it after this conversation. I am still pulling on a lot of these threads, but it's called The Felon's Ball. And it's set, it's a woman who owns a yoga studio in a small town in Virginia. And her family, they're very respectable right now, but they have kind of a criminal past. So she gets kind of pulled into some of their, the issues that they've had in the community. So it's really, really fun to work on.
Very cool. No, that sounds great. Is it, and it is set in a small town as well, you said?
Yeah, it's actually Ewald County, which is mentioned a lot in this novel. It's sort of the more rural county next door. It's set there. And I'm not trying to create my Southwest Virginia, but maybe I am, because I just, I'm happy to keep writing in this territory for the rest of my life. I love it so much.
I do. I feel like, I unfortunately do not live in the mountains. I'm about 2 hours from them, but I feel like every time we go there, it's like the setting just speaks to you. Like, it's a place where you can just almost feel a history and like anything is possible. And like, you can see the most beautiful parts of a place and also imagine all the scary things that can happen to it. I feel like there's just so much, it's just like the perfect place to set suspense.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Appalachia is such an interesting place because we have, culturally, we have all these stereotypes about it, but you know, it's a huge region of the country and all kinds of people live there and there are all kinds of different communities. But you're right, I think there's something about the setting. It's so beautiful, but yet it's so mysterious. It's so rural in many places that I think, I mean, it's just endlessly fascinating territory.
There are lots of pockets. There are lots of hidden pockets. I lived in East Tennessee and used to go to Asheville, all of that, you know, the Blue Ridge Parkway. There's a whole, you know, the Appalachian Trail all by itself has a whole, you know, sort of push through of mystery with disappearances and, you know, Tess, remember how little kids get lost in the rhododendron hills or, you know, there'd be a stalker on the trail or, you know, and there's it's a really old part of America. It's where the Scots came, you know, when they left Scotland after Culloden. Many of them went to Canada, but a lot of them went to North Carolina and took with them, you know, their distilling skills and their ballads and their, you know, their weaving and a whole very independent way of life. You know, Kate's Cove used to be this little pocket, I'm told, because I just had an author here, Mike Madden, who lives in Sevierville. So Kate's Cove is no longer Kate's Cove. But for a long time, it was this very strange little pocket in the inside the Great Smoky National Park that hadn't been updated since the 18th century. They even still spoke in the old language. And, you know, they had the old grist mill and the whole bit. I mean, now I understand the vacation homes have wiped out all of that. But, you know, I think there is, and also just the Smoky Mountains, why are they called that? Is it the fog? Was it the chestnut trees, which one hopes might come back? But, you know, there's a lot of hidden pockets. And, you know, Megan, in your April book, you have a whole thing that happens because of this geography and this climate. And, you know, it's a very powerful story. I recommend it to Polly if you haven't read it yet. About, you know, something that happens in school, right? And then it's not safe to go back and look at it all those years later.
Yeah,
that seems to be, you know, the real thing about a small town is the successful cover-up or the deep secrets, the secrets that have been deep sixed actually, and then somebody comes back and decides to pry the lid off in one way or another, which is a lot different than just sort of ordinary urban violence, you know?
Yeah. I think that's definitely, I mean, I think that was something you talked about in your book too, was how the police, I mean, some of the characters were from a powerful and wealthy family. And in a small town, like they're very connected to the police. And were the police asking the questions they should have asked, or was everyone kind of happy to let things die with, you know, a different suspicion?
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, I think in a way we would all like to think that the police would just do their jobs regardless. But I mean, I'm sure you guys are familiar, like with the Murdoch case that I've been obsessed with in South Carolina.
Wow, yes.
20 years of everyone in town knowing that this family was committing crimes and no one did anything. So this, I mean, this is a reality in some parts of the country.
We're seeing it on a national scale, even as we speak. So I like Lindsey Graham's spin on the whole thing, saying, well, at least he wasn't a spy. Like, that's some kind of, you know, I mean, it's really, there's this alternate reality going on that I think it's important for you guys, you know, to try, even though if you're writing fiction, I think in many ways your fiction is more real than the real world as we are currently seeing it. I mean, there's justice, there's retribution, you know, secrets come out, people react, there are consequences,
which
I think in many respects we are losing. But I mean, in a thriller, there have to be consequences, right?
I think that's the satisfying part, is that there are consequences to the actions. And that's the thing that the journey that the characters are taking and the readers are taking, is that sense of closure that comes from either the answers or, like you were saying, the consequences. Definitely.
I had a conversation with James Patterson because we launched his last book, and I don't read all of his books, but I have to tell you, the last one is really terrific. And it's once again, a Washington, D.C. dynamic and so forth. But in the conversation, he said that all novels are political. And, you know, I found, because in a way they really are, you know, whether it's a mystery, whether it's a thriller, whether it's, you know, even a romance, at its core, you know, there has to be an issue. Otherwise, it's just boring or meaningless. But maybe political is a big word, right? Maybe it doesn't just mean specifically like voting.
Yeah. No, I definitely think there are things that happen in the world that you're thinking about when you're writing a book. And it's not necessarily like you're trying to say, like but you're thinking about it, and that question kind of makes its way into every layer of your story. I definitely have had that happen, and not necessarily thought, oh, this is political, but I think it definitely was and had a piece of that element to it. Do you feel the same, Polly?
Yeah, I do. I mean, for me, you know, the other sort of inspiration for me, I think, getting into the genre, my mom is a criminal justice professor. So we talked about criminal justice at the dinner table every night, and sort of the sociological aspects of it. So when I think about crime, I'm interested in the story of it, but I'm also, you know, in every case, there are so many other issues around it in terms of who is held responsible and who isn't, and, you know, how is the victim portrayed? And those are absolutely political issues, I think. Yeah.
I was reading in the Washington Post, I think it was, maybe the New York Times today, about the six-year-old, who shot his teacher. But now they've arrested the mother, and, you know, all kinds of issues are coming out. And, you know, they're not going to charge the child, but they're going to sentence the mother to prison for letting him have access. Wait, where is justice in any of that? You know, if you think about it, what are the issues involved? Can you hold a child that responsible? You know, can you, you know, what is the mom's role in all of it? You know, what about the teachers who ignored various warnings? You know, there's so many agendas and so many actors in a thing like that, that, you know, it's difficult to sort out what the consequences for everybody should be.
Love to read a novel based on that kind of situation, because you're right, it's so complex, and I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but you think, you know, for that child who is now going to grow up with a mother in prison, I mean, does that just kind of compound what's already happened to him? You know, it's just, it's so complicated, and it's so tragic, you know, and I think stories are sometimes the only ways we can make sense of situations like that.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree. I think stories are how we make sense of the world. Increasingly, journalism is not helping us right now. So, you know, maybe stories really are the way to go. So I would like to compliment both of you on your writing skills. Your prose styles are both so elegant and so polished. I'm a reader who really appreciates the, you know, elegance in writing. And I thought, Megan, when I asked you to do this, that you would like Polly's writing in addition to what she said.
Yes. And I did. I feel like for me, and I'm a huge thriller fan. I love all sorts of books, but there's a moment when you start the first page and you start reading and you sink into the world immediately, and you can see the perspective of the narrator through, like, I mean, I just pulled out like two lines in the first five pages that I was like, I have to ask her about these, because they just, like, a single line can open up their entire, this is how they view the world. This is how, like, something that they're revealing about themselves. It was just so beautifully written. And that is, to me, I am a sucker for, like, voice. Like, that is the thing that speaks to me the most in a book. And then I'll follow that character anywhere. And it was such an incredible journey to follow Nicola through this story. So thank you for thinking of me for it, Barbara. And thank you for the book. Yes.
Well, I'm gonna read a line that I think is absolutely magnificent. And it comes at, you know, at page 280. This is not a spoiler, but I just love this line. In Tyndall County, social capital meant having the right husband and the right house and the right neighborhood. Aunt Lauren had signed on to that moronic vision of the good life before she knew what she was doing. I thought, wow, that is just such a beautiful encapsulation of this, you know, dilemma. And then dropping slightly in elegance, it goes on, fucking Sean. I love that juxtaposition too, you know, with this elegant language, then we get the F word. But as a, I mean, really, Polly, I think, you know, your writing is remarkable.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, I think we have a mutual admiration society here, because I absolutely feel the same way about Megan's work. And I think, you know, I do like thrillers that are fast-paced and not necessarily about beautiful language, but my favorite books are always the ones where people are putting a lot of thought into the prose. And I tried to do that here. Nicola's voice came very naturally to me. So I'm really glad that came across. That means a lot to me.
I am too. I'm going to recommend a book to both of you. It's by Matthew Goldman, who's an underrated writer. And his new book, which he will be talking to me about next week, is called The Good Neighbors, and it's set in Edina or Edina, I do not know how to pronounce it, Minnesota. But he really encapsulates what this, what's the word I want, upscale Minneapolis, you know, community is like. The plot, I think, he also has a real, I think, interesting kind of getcha thing, that you think one thing's going on and then another, but, you know, my point is that, you know, even a suburb can act like it doesn't have to be a rural town.
Yeah.
It can be. I wish, do you know whether it's Edina or Medina? Do you have any? Edina. I'll ask Matthew when I talk to him. But seriously, you know, I think you both really enjoy him for reasons that we've been discussing. So I'll mention that. Why don't we call Patrick up now that we've had this mutual rave and see whether we have anybody who wants to.
I'm writing my book list down here.
Well, now that I know I've nailed you, I'm going to send you more book recommendations. Right.
You know, I think you've just blown them all away. I don't see any. Let's see. Well, Robin says, I'm trying to place Megan's accent.
Oh, I don't think, do I have one? I don't know. I feel like it's
not much.
I grew up in New Jersey for 18 years, and then I lived in Boston, but I lived in North Carolina for 16 years now. So, or for 18 years, actually. So I feel like it's all a big mix.
That Southern overlay over the basic, you know, New Jersey. Or Boston. Boston actually is, I think, a more distinct accent than New Jersey.
Yeah. Yeah. When I go back to New Jersey, it slips back.
When I first went to California in 1958 to go to college, people used to stop and say car, because I was using this, so I'd say car, you know, the Midwest, and they'd all fall over laughing and go, no, it's car, it's not car. But you know, didn't you think today too that the internet and Zoom and all the rest has softened regional accents to the point that, you know, they're not as distinctive as they once were?
I definitely have found, especially, and I don't know if it's just, you know, the area I'm in, that a lot of people have come from different areas as well, and so I feel like it's a lot more of a mix, and everything is kind of softened. And yeah, I have gotten that sense here.
Maybe, but I have to say that doing Zoom events around the world, you can tell an Australian accent. New Zealand is completely different and very distinctive. You know, there are British accents. There's Oxford British, and there's regional British, and also, you know, it's not entirely true. I was really thinking more, maybe even in America. What do you think, Patrick? You've talked to all kinds of authors. Do you think that we still have those distinctive regional differences?
Yeah, I think they're there, but I think you're right that there's a lot of cross-pollination, and maybe the accents are diluted a little bit.
Or maybe we all get together, we sound alike on purpose, and then we come back.
I grew up in Arizona for the most part. I mean, I was born in California, but I don't know if I have an accent. And sometimes people say that an Arizona accent, there's a little bit of that kind of surfer dude sort of. I don't know. It's interesting. I think also accents can be, it's such a fascinating topic. I love it. Accents can be determined not just by regional, you know, the accents, but by, if I found that if there was somebody in your life that was very important and very influential to you, sometimes you can pick up a little trace of their, and it might not be an accent as much of just a way you talk. Right. I mean, Diana Gabaldon, sorry, Diana, if you're watching this, but she has a very interesting way of speaking.
Yeah, she does.
And it's unique to her. However, her daughter does, one of her daughters sounds exactly like her. And Sam has picked up some of her mannerisms. And it's not really an accent. It's, what would you call it, Barbara? It's just...
It's partly the way her mind works, because her brain goes at twice the speed of a normal person. So, you know, that has a lot to do with it. This is the Outlander author. She lives here. I think part of it, you know, maybe her Hispanic roots, and part of it maybe, I don't know, a lot of things. But I think part of it is just that her mind operates that way.
You know,
top speed.
Sorry. I do think there's something maybe more to like family and the people around you than regional necessarily. My dad was
And then some of it is, you know, social strata within. I mean, I think, you know, in any community, I think, you know, their economic and social layering, as you point out in Polly, and maybe that also, you know, maybe a question of who you are, who your closest groups are in that community, education level. I think college tends to flatten us out, you know, maybe for people who, you know, don't do that, they might sound more like they started than if they got certain amount of, you know, leveling out, polishing later. I know my accent changed, you know, in my 5 or 6 years in Palo Alto. I didn't sound at all like I did when I got there. So who knows? I don't know, Patrick. That's an interesting question about Arizona accents, but there are hardly any native Arizonans. So, you know, I mean, there aren't, you know, that's why the private eye industry, should you want to write a private eye novel, Arizona's the place, ladies.
Interesting.
Yeah, really? Because, you know, everybody is from, almost everybody's from somewhere. And when you don't know who anybody's background, what their background is, then there's a, you know, investigation becomes an important thing. And I won't mention who it is, but recently a young man of my acquaintance has a new girlfriend. And I said, in my excited way, as a gram, how did you meet? Oh, he said it was on, I don't remember which dating app. And then looked sort of chagrined and said, that's how we all meet these days. You know, you don't want to go to a bar. And I thought, okay, but you know, what do you really know about anybody that you meet in that?
Girls love him. Who you're talking about, by the way.
Yes, I know. but he's right. I mean, in a place where people you don't have families making matches for you and all the rest of it, indeed, you know, a dating app would be the most logical way to go about. And then I realized that my younger daughter and her husband, who've been married now for whatever, they met on whatever dating app it happened to be. I'd forgotten that. You know, so I mean, and so you've got lots of thriller, you know, potential there, right?
I was just thinking that.
So, yeah, people, yeah, right. I love
it. Have there been any good Tinder thrillers? Because that's definitely
sure there are.
TikTok Tinder thriller. That would be really exciting. I love it. Well, we've kept you a while, ladies, but this has been so much fun. Thank you very much. I loved having this conversation. We'll have to get you all together again. Polly, when are you looking for your new book?
Well, I'm going to finish it this summer. So yes, hopefully I'll have an update soon.
Okay, and Megan, you're so reliable. Were we looking at spring?
Hopefully April.
April's an excellent month. Yes. It's also a decent month to come to Scottsdale as opposed to say July when you, Megan actually came to do a book event in July when it was probably like 120 or something. So
April felt downright cool. April
was way better, right? But anyway, thank you all for joining us. Polly's book, which I thought we haven't even mentioned the cover. I meant to say something about what I thought a dramatic cover this was. Yeah. So The Only Survivors, which is a great title for Megan's April book, really good title, and the good ones are waiting for you at the Poison Pen. So order up, ladies or gentlemen or whoever you are. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Bye, guys. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.